Welcome to Quimper UU Fellowship. We hope you enjoy this recording from our November 15th, 9:15 a.m. service. The topic is Just Gender. The speakers are Kathleen Crosston, Penny Ritterbush, Susan and Cindy Britton, with Reverend Bruce Bodie. Thanks for listening.
Our sermon conversation this morning is taking place a few days before this Friday's Jefferson County Transgender Day of Remembrance, which, as I said during our congregational announcements, is a combination of a vigil for transgender persons who have been murdered this past year and the viewing and discussion of the documentary film titled Two Spirits. I haven't yet seen that documentary, but this past week my wife Flossie and I did see another documentary titled Just Gender. It's a 2013 documentary film, about an hour and a half in length, that introduces us to the lives of a number of transgender individuals and couples, including quite prominently in the film Susan and Cindy Britton, who are with us this morning. And both Flossie and I found this a very compelling video film, and I trust that there will be an opportunity in the near future here to show that film as well as the documentary Two Spirits this Friday. We've titled our sermon conversation after the title of this recent documentary, Just Gender. It's a title that suggests three different directions to me. First, that what we're talking about is not the whole person, it's just gender. But just gender, it's probably the most fundamental aspect of our personal identity. It's the first thing that is typically asked at birth after learning that an infant is healthy, maybe even before. Is it a boy? Is it a girl? Gender is huge in society, in biology, in sexuality, and in the psyche. And most individuals quite easily take on the gender roles that are assigned to them in infancy and early childhood, that is, before conscious awareness. But there are others, and we will hear a couple of those stories today, who do not so easily receive their assigned gender roles. There's a third thing, aspect of that term, just gender, and that relates to justice for persons who do not fit the mainstream with regard to gender identity. So here's how our conversation will be structured this morning. First, I will invite the two persons with us who have transitioned, that's Kathleen Crosston and Susan Britton, to share with us something of their journeys with respect to gender, giving each of them about 7-8 minutes to speak. And then I will invite their marriage partners, Penny Ritterbush and Cindy Britton, to share some of their history and background, including their relationship with their partners, but they will speak a little bit less, 4 or 5 minutes. And then beyond that, this will be an unstructured conversation. I have prepared a few questions, but we don't know exactly where it's going to go. Now, we thought at first there might be an opportunity to have you, the congregation, ask questions, but in our meetings together, we found it's just not going to be possible with 4 different life stories and some conversation between us. But all 4 of our group today welcome individual questions from you after the service today and beyond that. And I want to thank them, not only for their willingness in that regard, but also to thank them for their willingness to be here this morning to share something of their lives with us on, this is on matters that are only recently, relatively recently, making their way into our society, and with all the misunderstanding and meanness and worse that goes with something new. So I want to begin now by inviting Kathleen Crosston to take a few minutes to share something of her life journey with us. Now, Kathleen and Penny, you have been together here in Port Townsend, I think about 5 years, and you've also been members of our congregation, or at least associated with our congregation for 5 years. And Kathleen, you are now in your first year as a board member. So what I guess I'd like to invite you to do is to say something about the part of your life that led up to this time here in Port Townsend. So you ready to go?
I am.
Okay.
So when Bruce first called about 6 weeks ago or so, and asked if Penny and I would be willing to be a part of this ceremony or whatever
service,
it is.
Service, actually.
Service with Susan and Cindy. I must say I was a little reluctant because I've really gotten used to just being my Kathleen self. It's been 15 years since I've had sexual reassignment surgery. And I live my life as a normal woman, and I enjoy relating to all of you in the way that we have. I enjoy relating to you just as my Kathleen self, a female senior citizen, you know, who's just one of you, and that's been really wonderful. So I haven't been a transgender activist or anything like that. On the other hand, having said that, you know, I've realized that truth will win out in the end. And some of you, I'm sure, have had notions that I'm a little different than the average woman, and so over time, I've become more and more comfortable with the idea of, you know, being completely out, as it were, as a transgender woman, and I'm finally fine with that, and Penny seems to be comfortable with it too. So having said that I really prefer just being a normal female, certainly my journey has not been the average journey. So I'll give you a little chronology of, you know, how I think it sort of happened. And but yet again, saying that, I really don't know how it happened because I don't understand fully how, you know, I came to be this self and why some people are transgendered and others aren't. It's still a mystery. So I was born in New York and lived with my family there from the ages of 1 to 5 when my family moved out here to the Pacific Northwest. And I have to say, I really don't remember any of that time between ages 1 and 5, but I have learned things in retrospect that I think really are significant. Like sometime when I was about 1 and a half or so, or maybe 2, I had an older sister. She was 9 years older than I was. And when she was roughly 10 years old, she fell off a roof while playing. And she wound up injuring her hip, and she had to wear a leg brace for a long time because of this disease in her hip. And she was wearing this all during my toddler time. And as I say, I don't remember it, but looking back and through a lot of therapy and whatnot, I realize I must have been really seriously envious of her getting all this attention from my mother for being disabled. And somehow, my therapists say that, you know, you must have thought in some way that in order to be a whole worthwhile person, you had to be that way too. Because, and I say that to, again, you know, no memory of this, but I do remember being in grade school. And you remember back in the 1950s, those March of Dimes posters that were up all over the place with the little kids and leg braces? Well, there was one in my grade school classroom with this little girl in leg braces. And I absolutely wanted to be that little girl. Powerful feeling. Yet at the same time, I realized that it wasn't true. You know, it was a fantasy. It wasn't reality. I was a pretty normal little boy at that point, you know, athletic, sort of rough and tumble. I didn't have any effeminate traits at that time in my life at all. So life went on, and I got to puberty, and, you know, 13, 14-year-old boy, and I realized if I was going to be attracted to anybody, I was like a normal boy. I was attracted to girls. But in contrast to maybe some other little 14, 15-year-old young male who might, you know, in order to get aroused, would maybe look at female pictures or something, which I did too, you know, when I was 14, 15, and 16. Still, the sexual fantasy that had the most powerful image for me, most powerful effect, was still of me as female, and at that time in leg braces. The leg braces thing kind of fell away over time, you know, and I realized how ridiculous it was. I wasn't crazy, and this is just a fantasy, and I can't say that it had a big impact on my regular life at that time at all. So I went on to a regular life, college, graduate school.
Can you do the next 40 years in 2 minutes?
Okay, all right. So college, graduate school, kids, four kids, and really my sex life with my wife was pretty normal, you know, and except I still had this, you know, fantasy thing going on in the back of my mind, which sometimes interfered with my normal sex life, but that's a long story. So anyway, around 48, 49 years old, I think I went into a pretty serious depression. I was bored with life, and the kids were all out of the house, and I really didn't like my job anymore, and I went pretty far down. And I don't know, I guess you might say I had one of the strangest and strongest midlife crises that you could possibly imagine. So, but this enormously powerful feeling came over me that I should have been a female all along. And it was a little bit like, I think I fell in love with the idea, the notion, or the image of myself as a female. And when I say fall in love, I don't know how many of you remember when you did that, but it was overpowering. There was a slight little, you know, sexual component to it, but hardly at all. It was really a psychological, overpowering emotional thing of being in love with the sense of myself as my Kathleen self. So, you know, still I knew that it wasn't true, you know. I mean, I still had my normal life. So I went to seek help at the Ingersoll Gender Center in Seattle. And, you know, to talk about this with other people who are having the same kinds of feelings. And I can't go into all of that, but what I can say was so powerful for me was I realized if I actually went forward with this and live, I thought in order to live a passionate life in any way that would be have any joy in it, I was going to have to live as Kathleen. But I realized the terrible trauma and pain that this would occasion for my wife at the time and my four kids, because I really loved my wife and we really had a great marriage. So this was painful at the deepest, deepest level. I can't say how painful it was. But still, it was so powerful, this feeling of wanting to be my Kathleen self, that it was almost like if I didn't, you know, I had to end my life or something. It was that powerful. So, let's see, I'm almost done now. And so At this point, I can say that my relationships with my former wife and children have gotten much, much better. My former wife and I are friends. My kids have finally sort of accommodated, thank goodness, and because a lot of transgendered people aren't that lucky. So I guess to end this, I can still say I really don't fully understand why this happened. But it did, and I've embraced my Kathleen self and look forward to interacting with all of you as my Kathleen self as life goes on. And now I am fully comfortable finally with being out, and Penny is supportive of that. And you know, let me just say that, you know, truth wins out in the end.
All right. Well, I'm Susan. This is my wife, Cindy. We've been married actually 33 years, I guess married as Susan and Cindy for the last 4 years. It gets complicated. Anyway, I have an American mother and an English father. I grew up in close to London. I was born in 1957, and on the day I was born, I guess I took my first breath and screamed. Every transgender person's journey is a little different. And I was wrapped in a blue blanket. And around 2 or 3 years of age, normally that's when gender starts to be identified by the young child. We start to know what hot and cold is, what's good and what's bad. We start learning words. Unfortunately, I didn't have the language to explain what was going on for me. The first time I realized that something was drastically wrong, I was in a bathtub with about 4 or 5 other kids. I was 3 years old, and I realized that I was not atomically correct, that I was not a girl. And from that moment until 2010, 50 years later, my life was never the same. And that gnawing, aching feeling that something was drastically wrong with me never went away. As most young transgender children do, the times are getting a lot better. There's a lot more information for parents out there now. I put on an Oscar-winning performance, just as Kathleen did. And we learn all the tricks of the trade. We learn all the unwritten rules that society has, and we learn not to break one of them. So by the time I was 5, I went to my first primary school, and I never forget that first day of school. Up to that point, for a young child, there are no gender boundaries. And suddenly, that first day of school, the boys lined up on one side and the girls lined up on the other. The boys played together, the girls played together. This was 1962, so things were a little different. But I remember that was a tragic blow for transgendered rights that morning. Because I remember standing in the playground and crying and thinking, this is not right. At age 8, I got sent to an all-boys public, which is in England is a private school, boarding school, Catholic, and it was horrendous. I hated every day I was there. But in order not to be beaten up, not to be left out, not to feel excluded, I learned to play rugby, I learned to play football, I learned to sail, I learned to be a tough kid. And every day, though, I had that one word at the end of every day, but, B-U-T, it's such a powerful word in every child's language. My day would have been fantastic, but. I would have had a great holiday, but. And this continued on. Puberty, oh my God. Whether you're a young boy wanting to be a girl or a young girl wanting to be a boy, puberty is one of the most horrific times in a transgender child's life. Suddenly, instead of becoming female, up to that point, there was that little bit of magic thinking still, maybe, just maybe at puberty, it won't happen. But it did. And with that becomes, for me, I had no coping skills, and I turned to alcohol. So in my teenage years, I was already a blackout drinker. I was not doing well in school. I dropped out of college after a year. And left England at the age of 23, I guess, in search of something that I didn't know what. I think for all transgendered people, we always think that something's going to cure us. Maybe if I just go to America, maybe if I change jobs. And eventually, in 1983, it was, I think I'm going to marry this wonderful person that I'm so in love with, and love will cure it all. And unfortunately, it didn't. This deep down thought that I was in the wrong body never went away. Having a son in 1985, I thought when I held my son in the hospital that finally I was going to find something that was going to fix this, and it didn't. 1986, my son was just 1 year old. I went to Johns Hopkins in Baltimore. They had the top transgendered program in the country there. And for 4 years, I sat with a therapist who tried to convince me that I wasn't transgendered. Because back then, if you wanted to transition, you basically had to divorce, move away from your family, and never see them again. And they couldn't even imagine two women back then raising a family, let alone a woman and a transgendered woman raising a family. And in 1990, I found myself locked in a room with two cops, five doctors, waiting for Cindy to come down and try and sort out what we were going to do. So what happens, every 3-4 years after that, I'd go through cycles of really intense depression and suicide. And most transgendered people, all transgendered people actually contemplate suicide. 50% of us try it on numerous occasions. And I'm one of the lucky ones here that's sitting before you this morning to say I made it through. And luckily for us, there is such an easy fix to this, and that's just becoming and finding our authentic self, spiritually, emotionally, and physically. For some transgender people, it might mean surgery of some kind. For others, it doesn't mean anything physically at all. It just means they want to identify in the gender they present. It's that simple. And that is what immediately society says we don't want. Anyway, by 2009, things had got really, really depressing. By the way, in between this, I'd become a tall ship captain. I ran tall ships, 400-passenger sightseeing boats. I worked for Sea Tow, doing commercial towing. Good redneck, you know, male stuff. But 2009, I finally sat down with a therapist who said, hey, let me ask you a question. You had three brothers. You went to an all-boys school. You work in a male-dominated industry. Don't you think you would have got the message by now? Don't you think you would have got the message that you're supposed to be a man? Do you think maybe you just might be transgendered? And I said, yes, I am. And then the hard part comes for the transgender individual. As Kathleen mentioned, we suddenly tag the ones closest to us with our identity. I'm out. This is incredible. Hey, guess what? I'm Susan. This is fantastic. There you go, Cindy. You explain it to your friends, please. And I wrote a letter to my son, who was in Evergreen State College here in Olympia. Hey, Daniel, guess what? Your dad's now your mom. You explain it to your friends. And when you're applying for a job and they ask you what your parents do, I'm sure you'll come up with a good answer. So anyway, as you can see, this isn't an easy path that we choose to tread. Unemployment for transgendered people is, I think about 50% of us are unemployed. Of the ones that are working, 90% of us make below the poverty level. So it's not something we just do for fun, something that we choose to say, hey, you know what, I think I'm going to enjoy life a little bit more like this. It's the fact that at age 53, I could no longer live as a man. And I realized that if I didn't do something to fix that, I was going to kill myself. So there we go. Hopefully that gives you a little bit of insight into who I am. And I think I'm going to turn back to Bruce.
Well, good morning. So there is no on-off, so it's up to them. Okay. I was born female, and I still consider myself female. But I was married twice, 10 years to my first husband and 19 years to my second husband. At age 47, I came to realize that I was a lesbian. So I had my own little midlife crisis. I was actually afraid to begin dating for two reasons. One was that I hadn't dated women, and the other was I had made very poor choices in my earlier life. I had been married to alcoholics or people who were possibly alcoholics, and most everybody that I had dated was an alcoholic or a drug user. So to protect myself, I made up some lists of qualities that were absolutely essential in a relationship and qualities that were deal breakers and a few things that were conditional. Well, I always loved New Year's Eve, and I liked fireworks, and I liked to go dancing, and there was a group in Seattle called ALPS, Associated Lesbians of Puget Sound, and they held a New Year's Eve dance every year. So in 2002, I decided to go, and it was at that dance that I met Kathleen. As we talked, she had everything that was on my must-have list, and it appeared that she had nothing that was on my deal-breaker list. It was really quite interesting, and I thought she was quite attractive. She was a little bit exotic looking. She was tall. And we decided that we were going to meet the next day over coffee, and we expressed that we both had something important that we needed to say to the other. And both of us thought that what we had to share was going to scare the other one off. And as we sat there at coffee, it was like, well, you go first. No, you go first. And so I ended up going first. And what I needed to share with her was that I was basically new to the lesbian world. There's a term in lesbian culture called curious. And it's a straight woman who's curious about being with another woman. And I was afraid that she would see me as being a curious person and would go running out the door screaming. She was actually fine with my disclosure. So then she disclosed that she had been born male. And I went, huh. And I'm really not sure exactly what my reaction was there. I mean, I knew of transgender people, but I don't think I'd ever met anyone personally before. So I went home after that meeting, and I thought, what kind of lesbian am I? That the first person that I'm attracted to was born male. And it's really interesting. It was very interesting to me how our own identity is wrapped up in who we are with. I know bisexual people have that a lot, that they're identified as straight or gay, depending on who they're with. But one of the things that I realized, and I've done a lot of soul searching in my life. I've been a member of Al-Anon for almost 30 years now and have really done a lot of work on myself, was that who she was had nothing to do with me, and who I was had nothing to do with her. And I liked her, and I looked at my list, and she did indeed have all those qualities that I wanted and none of the ones I didn't want, and there was nowhere on that list that this woman needed to be biologically female. So we gave it a go. As she stated earlier, she did want to be known as female. She did not want to be identified as a transgender person. And so I honored that. I did not disclose who she was unless I happened to run into someone else who was struggling or had recently identified with being transgender. And I would then mention that my girlfriend was a transgender person, and it allowed us to open the conversation, and then I let her know who I had told. But it was very few people. I also found that there were very few resources for somebody in my position. There were resources for the family member, like for her children, her spouse, the people going through the transition, but not really anything for someone who came in the late in the second act. So I really used my Al-Anon program and asked Kathleen questions when I needed to. I also found ways of advocating for transgender issues in subtle ways without disclosing why I was interested in the subject. One thing that was quite interesting was when we got married. We had a religious ceremony back in 2005. We were married legally in 2013 here. But at our wedding reception, my family was there and her family was there. And my family knew nothing, and they were having a hard enough time with me being lesbian. That I just figured it would probably put my parents over the edge to find out that Kathleen was biologically male. But then here are her children there who call her dad. And they were uncomfortable because they knew that my family didn't know, and it was really kind of an interesting thing. But I did email them before the ceremony, and I said, you know, we don't want you lying, but if somebody comes up with something like, oh, aren't you happy for your mother? You know, they didn't need to say, oh, she's really my father, that they could just simply say, we're really happy for Kathleen and Penny. They could say something neutral without lying. It's something that's wonderful about the English language because we have these wonderful gender-neutral terms, spouse, child, parent, sibling. There's a world of words out there that don't assign gender. Other languages, you have to say an A or an O on the end or something. There is nothing that's neutral. And we're very fortunate here that we do have that. So the reception went well, but we don't have our families intermingle. My niece one time was at her house, and we had to clue my niece in because if somebody called Kathleen dad, we wanted her to kind of get. And she was like, I don't know, 10, 12 years old or something, and she was just cool with it. It was like no big deal. Kids are great. I guess in closing, what I want to share is that when we do share our diversity and unique experience, we break down walls of isolation. We grow in understanding. And we realize that we are not alone. Thank you.
Can you hear me?
Yeah,
now you can. Anyway, well, thank you very much for inviting us to do this, Bruce, and all of you. I wrote a cheat sheet so that I could keep myself limited in time. But honestly, anyone who wants to ask us any questions, I think getting to know each other's personal stories is how we all can grow. And this is definitely a topic that has been greatly misunderstood and mistreated in our society. And just knowing that we're pretty normal. Anyway, Susan and I met. I was a military kid, so I grew up traveling, studied Spanish in college, got on a boat in Key West, and my life sort of went into the nautical stage. We met working on tall ships in St. Thomas in 1982. Had a whirlwind romance. She had a beard at that time, looked a little bit differently, and fell in love, and decided to get married about a year and a half later in 1983. And before we got married, she told me she had these sort of gender issues. And at that time, I had a lot of gay friends, and I didn't understand what transgender was, and there wasn't an internet at the time to look things up or a lot of literature out there. My biggest concern was I had a college class that mentioned a lot of transgender, almost all of them commit suicide, that they can't live with themselves as they are, and if they transition, they're not often accepted by their family and society, so even after they transition, this was in the 70s when I had that, and so I had this fear. I was already madly in love with this person and could not get married to him, her. This gets confusing now, talking in the past. But anyway, my biggest fear throughout our whole relationship was suicide, that this person I live with is somehow going to be exposed, feel ashamed, and kill themselves. But anyway, we got married, and when she told me these stories about her childhood and that she thought she was a girl, I believed her, and I didn't have any doubt that she was being honest about that. But we had a son in 1985, and as she said, I think she thought that was going to cure her, and instead, she felt like, oh my God, what have I done to this wonderful woman that I love? And now this child, I've burdened them with this, and how awful that someone would feel that way about themselves. I wouldn't feel in that way, but anyway, her depression got really bad, so we went to Hopkins. And we got wrong help and bad help. And when you go to psychiatrists thinking they're going to help you, and what they didn't get it. It wasn't that they were bad, but they just didn't understand enough in those days. Anyway, so they basically used that type of therapy, the aversion type of therapy, that was just made the situation kind of worse. So we kept plodding along, and so basically from 1987 to 2009, we were like the Beaver Cleaver family. You know, we went to PTA, we did soccer with our kid. He was in marching band. He's a great, great kid. Decided to study philosophy out here at Evergreen State College. He graduated in 2008. Both my parents, I went through the whole taking care of your parents, watching my parents die, helping them, move through that. And then here we are, 2009, it's just basically the two of us. Our son has graduated, decided to stay in Washington State that he loves. We're on the East Coast. And in recovery, supposing to have this wonderful spiritual life, and she's miserable. It was actually he then, and I was like, I can't live with your depression anymore. You have to get help. And you got to watch what you say and what you wish for, because she got help. And I'll never forget, came home after this therapy session around my birthday, and I said, how did it go, honey? You know, I don't want to talk about it. I thought, oh, it was a good one, And now we're going to make some progress. And right before 2 weeks, when she was supposed to go back, she sat down and told me she was going to change her gender. And I felt like the wind had been punched out of me. And I spent about 2 weeks crying almost every day, thinking my life was over. It was really unsettling. It was something I had been afraid was going to happen forever. I wanted to help her, but I just didn't, we didn't know how to do it, Anyway, this was not what I anticipated. I figured I was going to be dumped on the roadside and my partner was going to fall in love with a man, and this is not what transgender is at all about. And love is much bigger than that. Anyway, her therapist had been in a trans relationship 18 years prior, and there was not the help for them, and they got divorced, but stayed friends. And she moved into therapy, and now she counsels children, trans children, their families and parents, and I know we gotta hurry up. Anyway, she counseled both of us. And so, we both went to therapy. 2010, we told our son. She wrote the most beautiful spiritual letter, used that letter to come out to our family and closest friends. We decided to educate ourselves, and we went to a trans conference in Provincetown for a week, where we both wore name tags. That was the first time I called my husband she and Susan for a whole week. Nobody knew her and her other gender, and I realized I could deal with this. I could do this. And 2011, her name was officially changed to Susan. Her mother came over from England at 89 and went into the courthouse with us to go through the name change. And Bob has not been in the picture ever since. We became Unitarian Universalists because of her transition. Somebody invited us to come to a UU church where they embraced diversity. And she started off, we went in as Bob and Cindy, and then we came out as Cindy and Susan. And and they went through the whole thing, the whole cockapoodle stage, where it's very, when you're going through hormones and you're changing from a male to female or the other way, it's interesting is all I can say. Kind of like adolescence on steroids. So then we drove across America 2011 so people, our family and friends, could say goodbye to Bob and meet Susan and realize that we weren't crazy, that we were happy, and we were going to be okay. And we had a little ceremony. It was mainly for our son so that he could be a part of the whole transition. not just say, okay, your dad's leaving. We wanted him to see the different stages. We went to Mount Rainier, and we had a little tree release service where we left Bob in Mount Rainier and hugged this tree in the Grove of the Patriarchs, which was very special for the three of us. Bob damn near killed us. And Susan is much, much happier and better. Anyway, she got her first job in Chestertown, working in a theater. It was a job that she liked. She was a great boat captain. But how many of you are good at your jobs, and so you do it because you're good at it, but it kills you because it's not really what you want to do? So now she's becoming a writer. We came out here so we could be closer to our son, and so we could know him as a man, and he could get to know his dad as a woman, and that we could heal as a family. And we're so lucky that there's a Unitarian church. Did no idea that just before we become members, we'd be up here, but anyway, okay.
Well, thank you so much, really. And I have these great questions, and I'm going to think there may be an opportunity, perhaps, if we could show the other video sometime, and we could maybe have discussion following that. So I want to end with Susan. If you would say something about what's happening this Friday evening, then, with regard to the showing of that video and the Day of Remembrance.
Yeah. So the Transgender Day of Remembrance was set aside to memorialize those who have been killed due to anti-transgendered hatred or prejudice. That is, they were targeted just because they were transgendered, not because they were involved in a crime or a drug deal. The event is held in November to honor Rita Hester, whose murder on November 28, 1998, kicked off the Remembering Our Dead web project and a San Francisco candlelight vigil in 1999. Rita Hester's murder, like almost every transgendered murder, has never been solved. It's usually just dismissed by the police. Although not every person represented during the Day of Remembrance self-identifies as transgendered, each was a victim of violence based on bias against transgendered people. This day actually serves several purposes. It raises public awareness of hate crimes against transgendered people, an action that current media doesn't perform. And it's very difficult. 22 transgendered people have been murdered so far this year in America, which is about 10 more than last year. Those are the ones that I've reported. Suicides, we don't even know what that amounts to. Dave remembers, publicly mourns and honors the lives of our brothers and sisters who might otherwise be forgotten. Through the vigil, we express love and respect for our people in the face of national indifference and hatred. And basically, Friday night, we're going to be handing out small cards with the name of one individual that has been murdered last year. And you as an audience, if you'd like to come up to the microphone and read that name, we'd love your participation. Two Spirits is an incredible documentary about a young Navajo transgendered girl who left her reservation. And as they say, where old culture meets new culture, trouble always follows. And on this reservation, Two-Spirit people are revered. They're shamans. They are respected in their community. Outside of the reservation, transgendered people are not respected and revered. And she was murdered. It was one of the first hate crimes in America, and it follows the investigation of the crime, but also the whole history of Two-Spirit people in Native American culture.
Good, thank you. So could we express appreciation for...